I'm not the contract guru, I have to say. So there is another person there that knows all about the contract. So that's it. Thank you very much. Dear, oh dear.
You mentioned earlier, towards the beginning of your presentation, that you saw that there was that need to return to the community or to return to the public code or things in which taxpayer dollars have been invested. Is there more to come from your agency or the New South Wales?
You'll notice that I put, that's my personal opinion. We don't have an opinion that I know of in government. I think personally, all I can say is personally I think that seems like a very good idea to me, simply because I think it'll work better. I think it's the same in every two-way conversation. If it's only take, eventually somebody doesn't want to stop, doesn't want to give anymore. So that's my personal opinion. I suspect it will become very common. Well, we started in 2002, I think October. So, and I mean, anybody involved, as you would have been in this, knows it simply takes time until people get their heads around the issues. I don't think it's something you can start and do immediately. And I think really it was, this is a kind of, it's a growth, you just go through this. And as you understand one issue, the next comes up, and as you understand that one, it's a sort of, for us anyway, it's been a sort of a logical journey of slowly understanding and putting building blocks in place. So, yes, all I can say is we started in 2002 with our project. It was on the radar screen before that, but we have very few resources, actually, internally, and so, but it became pressing, I suppose, in 2002 to have a look and see what we should be doing. Let me ask, how can I predict? I mean, I'm sure your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I can only say my personal opinion, I suppose, which is I think, this is a wave and it's good to be on the front on your surfboard, basically. I think it's horses for courses always. My particular project happens to be an open source one. Yes, I'm sure you scan the press as I do. And, in different countries, it's different.
Yeah, just in terms of the journey, it seems to be trying to get a sense of whether we sort of pass that on to people who play along.
You know, I think the beginning parts are always the most difficult because that's when you have to come to terms with the thought changes that are needed. So I think the beginning parts are always going to be slower. That's what I would say. That's looking at what happened to me. Yeah.
The
boring bits, like you go, what happens is the government puts out a request for tender,
yeah.
Right? And anybody can come in and say, yes, they want a tender, and we hold meetings then to explain exactly what we want, and people can ask questions. And then there's a date given by which time you have to put your tender in. And then it goes quite through an involved process because everyone is read, basically from cover to cover by a group of people who then evaluate according to all of the different criteria. It's very much like going for a job with the government. They have these criteria and they evaluate it according to those criteria, give them points, and basically who's put in the tender becomes a bit irrelevant. You're sort of looking at these points, and when it comes up the end about, you know, that's how it works. And then eventually the decision made is who gets onto the tender panel. I have to say this is the first one I've been involved in, so it might be different for other ones. I don't belong to the procurement section of commerce, so I actually I have no idea. So I think the person to ask is Cameron Parler. If there's any such thing going on, then he may know better than me. That's been modified. That was one thing we did have to look at, I must say, but that's another thing to ask Cameron. But certainly that was an issue and has been an issue for a long time. It was actually quite a... we had to look at a few things at once. It was quite an active time for us, I have to say. And I think we were lucky in having a team that were able to really step over the boundaries that previously had been huge walls and really look at things in a new way. So, yes, that was one of the issues that was looked at. Oh, I'm totally out of my depth there. I can't comment on that at all. No, I'd like to know the answers. A big pardon. About for the panel contract. I mean, we have a position that agencies decide for themselves. That's why we produced the TCO template, so they can actually cost different solutions. So they've got a tool that's freely available and open, and they don't have to buy it each time they use it. They have to do those costings, and they'll come up with whatever, they'll buy the solution that looks best to them. This just gives them one more option, basically. It gives them an option that, because Linux is very widely used now, should actually be an option that they're considering. So the individual agencies will make that call. Yeah, we don't say you have to use it. We've got a lot of things on panel contract, and we don't say you have to use any particular one. The value is just making sure that there's a wide enough set of options, and that's why we needed this. Well, a previous speaker said, you know, we're going to watch and see if it adds value, and I think that's a very sensible approach. You know, we'll see. I'll be most interested to see. I think it's difficult to tell.
Are there any plans to consider databases, open-source databases?
I think that, I'm not in the procurement team. They may well have other plans. I think, you know, at the moment, from my personal point of view, looking after the open source group in New South Wales, I guess we'll have to discuss what we're going to do next. It hasn't come up for discussion yet what we're going to do next, or if we're going to do anything next. I think we're like everybody else. We'll see how this works and see that we have added value, perhaps, or not. And then we'll see. I read that they are. You ask them. I read what you tell me. I shall read your next article with much interest. Yes, no, I think everybody watches each other. we certainly watch what other what other governments are doing, and we're happy that everybody's doing something a bit different, and we can all help, you know, help each other along on the way. It's an interesting journey. I would be flattered to be in the same picture, or at least set of pictures, as Mark Shuttleworth. Don't need my disc here.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
You're welcome.
It's now my very great pleasure to introduce our next speaker. Brendan Scott from Open Source Law is going to talk to us about open source, both in Australia and around the world. It's almost like a whirlwind tour, if you like, of what to expect in other countries, in other jurisdictions. Yes, these were the small ones. Without any further introduction, I'll leave you with Brendan Scott.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. My name is Brendan Scott, and I'm here to talk to you about open source here and around the world. This paper grew out of a survey that we did, or that I did, for the Open Source Industry Association last year of all of the federal parties within Australia. We sent them out, as you do before election time, you send them out a letter saying, what do you think about open source? What do you think about this, that, and the other? And they send you responses back. However, I'm not actually going to cover those responses unless I happen to have time right at the end, because I sort of figured there were more interesting things to talk about. And those interesting, or those more interesting things, are what exactly is happening in the rest of the world. What I want to do today is have a track through sort of those places. Australia, I want to have a look at the federal level, then a couple of the states. I want to have a look at what's going on in the US, Asia Pacific, etc. It's largely going to be a taxonomy of what's going on where and who's doing what. That said, in some cases, I'm hoping to sojourn a while and go into a little bit more detail on what they're doing. In the course of the journey, I want you to look out for a couple of themes. And those are mere use. Where are people using things? The second thing is, where are people within government sharing things with other people within government? The third thing is, what's the view on technical standards within government? And the fourth thing is, what sort of strategic uses are being made of open source? Because right at the end of all of this, I'm going to say that's probably one of the failings of what's been happening in Australia, is not seeing the further picture of potential strategic uses of open source. At the end of all this, I hope to pull those themes out and give you a short summary of what's going on. And I also want to let you know, before I jump in and go through all of this, that there's actually a key axis of the world that I'm ignoring completely. And that's the axis of Brazil, India, South Africa, especially Brazil, India, because they traditionally have been very strong players in the developing world for open source sort of models. And I don't mean open source models, but I mean commons and sharing approach. The reason I'm doing that is because I had a look at the program, and Pierre Smith's talking about that tomorrow, so I didn't want to steal her thunder. But also because I wanted to focus on first world examples of what's going on to demonstrate to you this is not a third world or a developing world issue. Please be aware that in those areas or in those countries, there's a heap of things which are going on. All right, well, since we're in Canberra, I thought the best place to start is Australian government and what's happening at a federal level. You've heard this morning from a couple of speakers which sort of told you everything that I was going to tell you on this slide. Just an overview, you have Agimo, taking the running on open source at the federal level. They've released in the last hour or so that open sourcing guide. And if you have a look at some of the publicity around that guide, the phrase breaking lock-in seems to come up a lot. Some of the places where open source has been used at the federal level are Centrelink and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Those usages have tended to be on servers at a server level, and I've got some figures there. I wasn't able to track down the DVA figures. However, for the Department of Veterans Affairs, they've also released in December a request for tender for open source office productivity packages, and I don't know where that's up to. The other interesting thing to note, Agimo Squiz I put there because I wasn't quite sure where we were at, but we found out a little bit earlier this morning that it's all going ahead full steam with the release of some code. The thing that I found very important in my research was what the National Archives are doing. If you are sending some documents over to the National Archives and they happen to be in a format other than the open office format, they're taking your document and putting it in the bin and transferring it over into an open office format for storage. And the reason they do that is because they've had a look at what's on offer and they think that unless they store it in this format, they're not actually going to have access to it in 10, 15, 20 years' time. So they see the storage in open formats as being very important. All right, that was a quick view of federal level. What's happening in New South Wales? I think New South Wales has probably been the most vocal to date on open source and the support of open source. And these comments that I have here, that I've shown you here, are comments made by the Special Minister of State, John Della Bosca, in New South Wales. He's used terms such as, this is at the policy, at the Federal Labor Conference, I think it was last year, not 2003. He got up and said to a whole lot of business people that he intended to use the policy and administrative bulldozer to level the playing field for open source within New South Wales government. Elsewhere he's talked about open source encouraging development of the local IT organisations, particularly for SMEs. A couple of weeks ago he announced the results of the open source panel. As I understand it, and Elizabeth didn't actually say, I'm not sure whether those people have actually signed their agreements and are contractually bound just yet. I think that it's a short list. But on that short list there's like 10 or 12 vendors, of which at least two are SMEs from the Sydney Basin. So what about some implementations in New South Wales? The first one I wanted to mention is JIRS, or JIRS, which is a legal research tool, which I have to say I'm sorry that I've never used. But had I used it, I would be using open source software when I accessed it, because they moved over to an open source solution, I think it was late last year, after finding that their previous solution didn't meet their needs. New South Wales also has an interoperability framework which was released in 2002, and that interoperability framework lists open office documents or formats as an appropriate format for the storage of data. And we've heard earlier about the open source newsouthwales.gov.au, so I won't belabor the point. Perhaps the most widely publicised open source implementation within New South Wales is at the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. They've put Star Office and Mozilla on desktops in 1,500 desktops in registries, which is not to say that they have 1,500 registries, but they have 1,500 desktops through those registries. Registries, if you don't know, are where you go and get your driver's licence. You have to wander in and wait in line for a while and then have your photo taken. Or if you want to renew your car registration, that's where you go. There's about 130 registries throughout New South Wales. One of the things that they've discovered from having implemented open source, or these open source solutions at their registries, is that their support costs are substantially lowered because they haven't had to spend their time spinning their wheels correcting the effects of viruses which they'd been infected by. They felt that overall they've achieved a cost reduction of about 20%. And the final thing is that Microsoft has been much more attentive to them after having done this. So you might think that such a move might poison a relationship between a government department and a large supplier, but Microsoft has demonstrated that it's quite attentive and quite responsive to you, perhaps more attentive and more responsive to you when you go the open source path. So don't be worried about things coming back at you should you go down that direction. Next stop on the Whirlwind Tour is Western Australia. I wanted to talk about Western Australia not because of the Electronic Government Interoperability Framework, which talks about open office formats as well for the storage of data, nor do I want to talk about Open Source WA, which is similar, I think, to the New South Wales initiative. But I wanted to talk about the Open Source Demonstration Centres. They have one centre, I think, in Perth, where if you want to see open source working firsthand, you can just wander in off the street and have a look. They've got a shopfront with a number of machines running different versions or different applications for people to come in and have a look at and get a very practical experience of what it means to be open source. And that can be of great benefit when ordinarily people talk about an open source as an abstract concept. Elsewhere in Australia, I wanted to, slightly needle a couple of states, which are Victoria, the Northern Territory, South Australia and Tasmania, for not being too public about what they're doing in open source. When I had a look around, I really couldn't find much information about what they were doing. Although Avi has suggested that he might be saying something tomorrow when he has a chat about what's going on. So those states, you're dragging the chain, guys. Let's get some information out there. The other states, Queensland has got two implementations of note. The first is the Department of Transport, which has 300 servers running Linux, which were previously running NetWare and Windows, and the Cairns City Council, which asserts that they've saved 75% on their costs for a specific implementation of some servers up there. And if you need to find out about that, just talk to Oracle. I'm sure that they'll be glad to tell you. And in the ACT, there's a policy which was released late 2003, early 2004, which says that anyone who is doing a software procurement within the ACT must consider open source solutions. That's the quick circumnavigation of Terra Australis. From there I want to go to the New World. And the first view I want to give you from the New World is that of the federal level. And I should say, if there's anything you want to ask me a question about, please, I'm happy to take questions halfway through, but I'm not really stopping for breath too much, so you're going to have to stick your hand up quickly if you want to ask some questions. I wanted to talk about, in the US, I want to talk about the US at a federal level, at a high level, which is basically just this. And the thing to note there is the technical reference model, which talks about the need to store data in open standards. And it's not surprising that that seems to be a common theme of all the things I'm talking about. I also want to talk about a couple of code-sharing arrangements which occur in the United States. And the first one of those is called core.gov. Within the US, there's a problem, I guess you could call it, or there's a policy position taken by the US legislature, the federal legislature, that is quite similar to the view expressed by Dr. Gordon Werner a little bit before, which is that if taxpayers happen to be paying for the development of the software, once it's developed, they shouldn't have to pay for it again if they want to use it or access it. So all government-developed software within the United States is released into the public domain. So you would think that there would be lots of government software floating around out there that people could use. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. They did a review of software holdings and software usage, and they discovered that there wasn't people had this code, but they weren't telling people about it. People had needs which might be met by code which happens to be out there, but they didn't know how to get to that code. There was no way of knowing about it. So what they did was they created this thing called core.gov, which I think is www.core.gov. And the idea between core.gov is to provide information to US federal agencies to pool the usage of software. So if someone creates some software, they chuck it into the pool. And if someone else is interested in acquiring some software, they check the pool to see whether they've got some software in there that meets their needs. And the idea is, rather than a Linux sort of model where you acquire a complete solution in effect on your Linux distribution, what you acquire from core.gov are components. So you'll acquire a whole heap of components and you'll package it together for yourself in a way that suits your needs. And the interesting thing about this is that it's not a free-for-all. It's not all love and roses. In order to contribute software to the pool, you actually have to sign an agreement. And the reason that they do that is to require people to conduct a due diligence on the software on its way in, so that the people who are taking it on its way out can have some security over what it is that they're receiving. The next thing of interest in the US is almost a state equivalent of core.gov, and that's the Government Open Code Collaborative. It's a code sharing arrangement for state and municipal governments within the US. It was created by a couple of state governments, including Massachusetts was one of the main runners, but also I think Rhode Island, Oregon and California were also involved. As with core.gov, if you want to contribute software to GOC, you need to sign a contribution agreement. And the contribution agreement, as with core.gov, says that before you submit code, you have to conduct a due diligence on the code, so that the people who are taking it can be sure that they know what's going on. Whereas in the federal level it's all public domain, so licenses are not much of an issue, at the state level, the Government Open Code Collaborative is intended to cover both open and closed source software, as long as the closed source software is available for use by government agencies. They say they had some issues with vendors thinking that the code pooling was going to be some sort of competition with the vendors, but when they explained that they were just sharing code that they already had rights to use, the vendors didn't feel so threatened by it. Now, that said, if you actually go and have a look at the Government Open Code Collaborative, there isn't a lot of stuff there, but the people behind it assure me that in the near future it'll be teeming with life. In the next couple of slides, I want to give short vignettes on a couple of specific states in the US. And this is not intended to tell you everything that's going on everywhere, but to give you an idea of some of the things which are percolating along. The first is California. In California in 2002, they didn't pass a bill. They put forward a bill, the Digital Software Security Bill, which was effectively a let's future-proof government against vendors bill. And had the bill passed, it would have actually had the practical effect of requiring only the acquisition of open source software. That said, there's been a strong endorsement of open source happened last year in California with the California Performance Review. I think that the performance review is something which happens on a regular basis, but I think also that when Governor Schwarzenegger came into power, he asked them to be a little bit more diligent than they had been in the past. And one of the recommendations of that performance review was that the government should consider the open source software, because in many cases it provides the same functionality as closed source at a much lower cost of ownership, total cost of ownership. The other thing to note is the LA City Council, which, and I make reference to this here because of the wonderful quote from this councillor who says it's a no-brainer, we should be going open source, but also because in promoting this initiative, and I'm not sure where at what stage it's at, but in promoting this initiative, the councillors made the intuitive but not often recognised correlation between the consequences of going open source and the consequences of going closed source. And that is to say, they stated quite simply that the more that the council used open source software, the more things of importance, policemen, teachers, doctors, they could afford to have working for the public in their service. So I think that's something that should be kept in mind. The second state I want to talk about is the state of Massachusetts. And the news from Massachusetts is they're currently considering a new technical framework which is based around open standards and open document formats. And that's the Enterprise Open Standards Policy. Now, that policy was open for review until the 1st of April, and comments have closed on that, and they're still going through all of those comments, and they don't expect to have that completed by... expect to have that completed for a month or two yet. But the interesting thing about Massachusetts is that they have a policy which requires their government to acquire software which complies with open standards. And as a result of this policy, not unlike the RTA, they received a whole heap of responsiveness and attentiveness from one particular vendor who went along and changed the licences for their XML schemas in an effort to qualify those schemas as an open document format for the purposes of Massachusetts procurement. So let me reiterate, if you're thinking of going down the open source path, you're not going to annoy your large vendors. You're going to make those vendors become much more attentive to you and much more responsive to your needs. The third place that I want to talk about is the state of Texas. And in 2001, 2003, Microsoft conducted an audit of a couple of government departments in Texas, and the departments, and they found a breach of their licensing requirements, and those government departments were quite bitter about that because they felt that they actually were up to date in their licensing. It's just that some of the licenses they bought some time ago and they'd lost the paperwork on. It may not come as a surprise to you that these departments are now running Linux and open source systems. Further, in Texas, they've done a standards review and produced this SRR pub document, which has guidelines for Texas state agencies and higher educational institutions. And that document suggests that agencies should consider open source solutions in all of their IT procurements. And they also say that agencies should prefer to use solutions which have open source, it's not open source, open document formats and open standards. And they also suggest that people should join the GOCC, which the Government Open Code Collaborative that I talked about a little bit earlier. That's the US. Three states out of 50 is not that much, but it gives you a short window onto what's going on there. For an even shorter window, let me talk to you about Southeast Asia. Actually, that should read Asia Pacific rather than Southeast Asia because I've thrown New Zealand in there, but I hope you'll bear with me on that and won't hold it against me too much. Here I just want to pick out some headline things which have been happening in Southeast Asia. And the first thing is that some governments in Southeast Asia see Linux as an opportunity to grow their IT markets, to give them an edge into something that they've previously been locked out of. And for that reason, Japan, Korea and China have moved together to produce an Asian version of Linux, which is due to be released in June this year. India I'm skipping over. Vietnam has invested $20 million over the next 4 years in the open source, investing in open source development within Vietnam. New Zealand, the district, I think DHB stands for District Health Boards, they're trialling open office in the hope of saving $20 million. And I think that's New Zealand dollars, not US dollars. Thailand has published a policy encouraging both public and private sector organisations to adopt open source for servers for office productivity applications, and they've said that they can migrate other things later. So within Thailand, there's strong government support for the adoption of open source. Within Singapore, the Ministry of Defence has already installed 5,000 desktops with open source productivity applications. I think that's Open Office on the desktop, and they plan to have 20,000 installed by this time next year. And the other one which is of interest is a reflection of that theme that we were talking about with the RTA and Massachusetts, and that is when you do something in open source, you tend to get attention. Over the last couple of years, a couple of countries in the Southeast Asian region have proposed the creation of these people's computer projects where you can get Linux preloaded on some hardware sold at, I'm not sure whether it's sold at a subsidised price or whether it's simply sold at a no-profit sort of price, but it's low-cost hardware with Linux on it. Soon after these countries, and they all announced these at different times, but soon after they announced them, the price of a combined Windows, XP and Office in that country tended to drop a little bit, and by a little bit I mean roughly 85% of the previous price. So if you're in a procurement section within Australian government and you think that you're doing pretty well to get 50% off the price of your licences, spare a thought for how well Malaysia and Thailand and Indonesia are doing. On Malaysia, Malaysia is actually a bit of a standout in that they've set up a unit called the Public Sector Open Source Software Initiative, which is part of the Prime Minister's Department, and they are charged with promoting the uptake of open source within Malaysia. And they've got an open source procurement preference, so they are to prefer open source when they're doing their procurements. And they also have this master plan. They have a roadmap for the adoption of open source within Malaysia, and they've got some targets for 2005. And some of those targets include 100% of CIOs being aware of open source within the next 12 months, 100% of all IT people within Malaysian public service being aware of open source within the next 12 months, 20% of school labs within Malaysia to be installed with OpenOffice. Sorry, they don't say OpenOffice, they say open source productivity software. 60% of web servers to be open source, 30% of office infrastructure to be open source, and 30% of desktop solutions to be open source within the next 12 months within Malaysia. And their reasoning behind this was that they'd done some research into open source, and that research had indicated to them that open source does a number of things. It helps improve the public delivery of services to the public. It enables greater and more pervasive use of ICT. It grows the local software development industry. It allows the cheaper production of localised versions of software. So if you want a Malaysian version of software, you get it cheaper. Reduces the digital divide and creates a knowledge-based economy. So you can see that that Malaysia are taking a higher level policy approach to open source than you've seen elsewhere. That's enough for Southeast Asia. Why don't we zip over to the European Union? And for the whole of the European Union, I basically have this slide. There are a couple more slides to deal with, specifically the UK and Germany. But the EU has set up the IDABC, which strangely is an acronym for the following, and count the letters when I read it out to you. The Interoperable Delivery of European E-Government Services to Public Administrations, Businesses and Citizens. Clearly they thought that the acronym was a little bit too long. The IDABC has this thing called the Open Source Observatory, and that is a place where news, case studies, facts, resources are available from over there. Like the examples we've seen earlier, they've established competency centres, such as the one that WA has, but they've got a number scattered around Europe. They've produced some migration guidelines for moving towards open source, and they've also conducted a feasibility study for the pooling of software at the European government level, similar to what we saw in core.gov and the GOCC. In addition, many states have published feasibility studies or migration guidelines, and I'm not going to go into detail about those, but I will give you a list of them, and they include Austria, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Italy, Norway, the Netherlands, Slovenia, and the United Kingdom. So why don't we talk about the United Kingdom? The Office of Government Commerce in the United Kingdom has produced an open source policy, and that policy says that, as we've seen in I feel like I'm a bit of a record here, but government should consider open source solutions in their IT procurement. They should only use open standards and specifications, and they should attempt to avoid lock-in. And I guess this is the standout thing about the UK government. This last one, that they should explore open source as a default IP commercialisation route for government-funded R&D. This is something that that I have advocated in the past, or in fact I advocated at this conference last year, that government should do something like that along those lines. And it's interesting to see that the UK is doing that. And they also there's also a report out which says, which effectively establishes open source's credibility. That's that October 04 report. Open source is now a genuine competitor to Microsoft in the public sector. That's policy in the UK. Here are some examples of implementations. The first one is the Applause project, where the government, rather than having all of their local councils spend the same amount of money on different vendors developing a CMS system for each of them, the government said, look, here's some money, why don't you produce one CMS and all of the councils can use it. And that was the output of the Applause project. And 30 councils have adopted that solution so far. In the Bristol City Council, there are 5,000 users of Star Office, and they reckon that they've saved £1.4 million, or they will save £1.4 million over 3 years. That's a projected usage. They have run a pilot of 600 people, and obviously that went well enough for them to decide to go further. The more interesting one is the use of open source in health. The National Health System has 5,000 seats of the Java desktop system in place. But more importantly, they ran this implementation at a particular hospital of the picture archiving and communication system, which is a load of open source components which have been knitted together to provide specific email and imaging and email functionality. And the report, which is quite detailed, and you can, if you want a link to it, let me know. I'll send it through to you. Estimated that in the first year alone of that project, they saved 4.7 million euros, and that over the following 5 years, they expected to save a further 8.3 million euros. So, 12, 13 million euros they're saving from a particular implementation. And it wasn't even one that involved office productivity, the things that we've been talking about previously. Elsewhere in the UK, it wouldn't be complete if I didn't mention the Munich installation, which I think hasn't really got far down the road of actually putting Linux on desktops. But the idea there is that they'll have 14,000 desktops converted to Linux at the end of the day. In Vienna, they're thinking of moving up to 7,500 desktops over to OpenOffice. Bergen has got OpenOffice in 100 schools, and the city of Bergen, which is different from the schools, purports to have made 30% hardware savings and 50% licensing savings on moving to an open source solution. Holland and Geneva, the entire canton, the administration of the entire canton is to be moved over to Linux by 2009. And when they announced that, the general manager of the State Centre for Information in Geneva said, I can't imagine an open administration without adopting open systems. Okay, that's Australia, US and the EU. There's actually one more slide that I wanted to give you on the EU, and I've kept this one up for last because I think it's perhaps a little bit more interesting than the last couple of slides. You might recall in the last couple of slides we've been talking about 1,500 desktops here and there, a couple of hundred servers here and there. France are actually a lot more serious than the rest of the EU. I think you can say that France has decided to take a bit of a leadership role in open source. They've set up a project, which I don't know the acronym for ADEL, but they've set up a project for the promulgation of open source within the French administration. They require that the French public administration use open standards. And as you can see, that they've got some quite significant open source implementations. The France police force already has 35,000 open office desktops. The Ministry for the Interior already has 30,000 open source desktops. By the end of the year, they expect to double those numbers or more. If you're looking for examples of where open source has actually been implemented on a rather large scale, don't worry about looking at Munich, don't worry about looking at Centrelink. Have a look at France, because they're actually getting the runs on the board. The other important thing to note about France is that they're not pussyfooting around on the issue of open formats or open storage formats. If you're in the French public administration, by default, from January 2005, you're using OpenOffice storage formats as the default format for the storage of your documents. That does complete the look at the EU, or it completes the look of the EU at a policy and implementation perspective. There's also an aspect which I think is perhaps going to get a lot more attention in the next couple of months or years, and that is more strategic uses of open source. We saw open source in Malaysia as being a form of industry development. What the French are doing is strongly investing in their locally produced distribution of Linux to security harden it, but they're also using it as a rather than taking open source in and using it, they're actually using open source as an external tool. So they're providing support for Africa. Using open source tools to provide internet access to African communities. You still with me? Still awake? All right, well, in the next couple of minutes I want to sum up, and I want to have a look at some of the things which I think are best practice coming from the review that I've just taken you on. The first thing is everyone's adopting an interoperability framework, and I think in terms of Australia, we're there. We've probably every jurisdiction seems to have one. Repositories for the facilitation of code exchange is something that we've seen in a number of places, and I'm not aware of something similar in Australia. A key component of the interoperability framework is storing documents in open formats, and by that, they don't mean, well, it will interoperate with the rest of my products, Mr. Vendor. It means any vendor is able to interoperate with those document formats. There's a value for money comparison, which seems to be coming out in everything that you read. There are active open source procurement policies in a number of places, not something that we've seen so far in Australia, except perhaps in New South Wales has given some hint that they might be willing to do that. Open source can be used as a means for supporting domestic small and medium enterprises. And on all of those things, Australia doesn't come out too badly, at least when you're talking about the federal government and New South Wales. But I think that there's more that can be done to get us up to that best practice level. There are a couple more slides, I don't think I'll go into the detail of those slides. They talk about some issues to do with interoperability and how do you define interoperable standards. I might skip through to that one. Pitfalls. What are some problems with open document formats and open document standards? I've said quite often that you should be using them. How do you identify them? And it's not really very easy to identify them. And particularly, a vendor might come up to you and say, look, here it is, I've published a specification. And then they might say, well, and by the way, I happen to have a patent here in my back pocket, which is going to stop anyone from using it. Well, if they've got that patent in their back pocket, then the document It doesn't matter who can look at it or how well specified it is. It's not an open standard unless and until they put that patent on the table and say, look, you're not going to infringe the patent if you implement the document format or the document standard. There are problems in defining interoperability standards because government has tried in the past and business hasn't followed them. So there are a couple of white elephants littering the history of open standards. I think what you need to do when you're looking at open standards and open document formats is not talk about the standards, or not talk about it as if it's a characteristic of the standard, but it's a characteristic of the market. Are other vendors able to implement the standard? Are there any barriers to them doing that? If there are those barriers, then it ain't an open standard. If you've conditioned the market properly, then you can just let the market work it out, and you don't have to go into too much detail about saying which, describing what's in the standard. You don't have to be too prescriptive about it. Where you have specific needs, you can say, well, I need this and I need that, but you don't have to get in and do the whole thing. Because if all vendors are able to participate, then all vendors will work it out over time. Whereas if one vendor happens to have a stranglehold on the standard, then you're not going to get that evolution. I will skip through to... everyone thinks... The results of the survey was that everyone thinks that open source is wonderful and they support it. Although to varying degrees of activity depending upon whether they were a small party or a large party. I think, and summing up, I'll just sum up while you can flip through those points. I think that Australian governments are trapped within a procurement box. They see open source and the issues relating to open source as being one of procurement. How do I procure it? And if you have a look at what's happening in the rest of the world, other governments are moving beyond that. They're not really worried about procurement. It's almost like that's a given. They're looking at where open source can play a more strategic and more important role in the local economy, but not only in the local economy, but also as a defensive weapon against foreign economies, and also as a weapon to insert themselves into other economies. If you have a look at France, Malaysia, and that Japan, Korea, China coalition, you get a sense of where they're going to. Open source, and I think that this is somewhere that Australia really needs to pull its socks up on, because everything to do with open source plays to Australia's strengths. Open source has traditionally been a very innovative country, a community of people who are very inventive, but they have trouble accessing distribution channels. And the advantage of open source is that those distribution channels often take care of themselves. If you want to get some open source software, you download it yourself. You don't have to have it pushed to you by a vendor. We're strong in services. We're strong in IT services. If you have a look at the spread of where the money is spent on the IT deficit, we run a $17, $19 billion IT deficit in Australia. And of all of the spectrum of things that we're buying and selling, the only thing that we run a surplus in is in the sale of services. And la-di-da, open source happens to be an area in which services have a strong part to play. Australia is overrepresented in per capita developers of open source. We're already punching above our weight in the open source area. So open source presents an opportunity to capture a greater share of the IT market, than we've taken to date. I think properly played, it'll substantially reduce our IT deficit, but it requires some forward planning and some strategic investment.